friends, welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihe Suhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We have around 50,000 refugees stuck in Greece. The majority of them, I don't think they know what their next step is. I think they still expect for the borders to open, for the Balkan routes to open.
That's reporter Mariana Karakulaki in Greece giving an update on the refugee situation there. Details coming up.
Also, Pakistan is mourning the death of at least 70 people in Sunday's Taliban suicide bombing in the eastern city of Lahore, targeting Christians. Belgian authorities released the sole suspect in last week's terrorist attack in Brussels, and two Nigerians are going to Cameroon to possibly identify a girl who says that she was kidnapped by Boko Haram insurgents 2 years ago at a boarding school in Chibok.
We have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Pakistan is mourning the death of at least 70 people in Sunday's Taliban suicide bombing in the eastern city of Lahore, targeting Christians. Hospital officials say up to 30 children were among the dead. The blast occurred in a crowded public park and wounded more than 300 people. Many of the victims are from the minority Christian community who were in the park celebrating Easter. A military spokesman said today security agencies have conducted several operations based on initial leads and arrested a number of suspect terrorists and facilitators from areas in the provincial capital and two other cities of Punjab, the country's most populous province. He shared no other details. A spokesman for a breakaway faction of the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the deadly bombing, saying it was aimed at Christians. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif arrived in Lahore this morning, where he chaired a meeting of top civilian and security officials. While Sharif said it will not deter efforts to eliminate extremism and terrorism from Pakistan.
The lone suspect charged in last week's terrorist attacks in Brussels has been released. Belgian prosecutors say there's not enough evidence to hold them. The French news agency says the federal prosecutor's office has released a statement saying the indications that led to the arrest of Faisal C were not substantiated by the ongoing inquiry. As a result, the subject has been released by the examining magistrate. Local media had identified the suspect as Faisal Shefu, who identified himself as a freelance journalist. In related news, violence erupted in Brussels yesterday during a candlelight vigil that's been underway since last Tuesday. Reporter Esther Gidou is following developments in Brussels. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold about yesterday's violence and current security issues.
Tuesday night, that was the night of the attacks. That was a very spontaneous vigil that appeared on one of the main squares of Brussels. The vigil was attended by a number of politicians, including the entire government, who went down there. It's been very busy, and people have been congregating over the 3 days of mourning, which officially has ended now in Brussels. And yesterday, 450 football hooligans went down yesterday afternoon to supposedly show their support, which escalated into a full-scale riot. There was a Muslim shopkeeper who had his shop front smashed in and was also beaten up. The police actually had to use water cannons to disperse the crowd, and a number of arrests did take place.
What sparked the violence in this demonstration?
Well, the 450 men who were largely men who made their way down there are linked to different far-right groups and specific football clubs which have been known for their violence, be it anti-Islamic violence or to anti-immigration violence or general just football hooligans. So it's perhaps not surprising that these men then made their way down with this specific kind of violence. There's no specific event that triggered this.
How effective was the security in stopping the violence?
I would say that the police were actually very effective in putting out the violence when they decided to do so. It was quite clear that these 450 men, which is a very visible presence of people, moved their way down, which is a direct boulevard from Gare du Nord, which is one of the central stations in Brussels, right down the boulevard, which hits the vigil. But it did take some time to get the police to actually start acting. It was only once the violence specifically to do with this one Muslim shopkeeper broke out, the police did eventually take action. I have to say also that the crowds, the hordes, I would say, of largely football hooligans managed to walk all over the candles and messages of support that had been left on the square. So Brühl Square, people met, was this very natural place to come to and to hold a vigil for the victims. People had messages of support that they'd written in chalk on the ground. This is something quite unique to Brussels that we didn't see, for instance, in Paris after the attack. Flowers, people coming together, lighting candles. So that was the aim of it. And then it sort of sprung up and has become the official meeting place and the official place to come and show support, solidarity, and also to mourn the victims. In terms of the violence, I would say there's no proof or no evidence that this was an organized form of violence, that it was supposed to be purposely to come into conflict with the immigrant community here in Brussels. I would say very much that this is something that escalated. The men that associated, or the groups that are associated to this football hooliganism, are known for their violence, yet there's no evidence that this was a planned violent protest, but much more something that came spontaneously and perhaps with the emotion of the entire event.
What is the sense of security in other parts of Brussels now?
There's the third man from the airport attacks, from Zaventem airport attacks, which was the first bomb to go off on Tuesday morning, who is still unidentified. And in fact, while Tuesday morning, very quickly after the attacks, the police released an image from CCTV of this unidentified third presumed attacker, they have now released an entire CCTV video of this man to help identify him. So in terms of security, there is very much a sense of insecurity that there is still more attack, or directly related to Tuesday's attack, out on the loose, potentially. There were 13 raids that were carried out on Sunday, which a number of arrests did take place, and the number has now risen to 4 people in Belgium, in any case, who have been charged on terrorism charges. There is a growing, or at least a very present hotbed of radical extremism in this country, which is very much something that has been exposed and definitely highlights a sense of insecurity in terms of Belgian society, and I would say even more European society and perhaps the West at large.
Tell me then, what is the latest death toll? I understand 2 Americans who were missing are now declared dead.
As far as I'm aware, there were 2 Americans who have been confirmed dead. They were confirmed missing. There's 28 out of the number of dead have now been identified. The other remaining numbers are still yet to be identified. I would also add, which is very disconcerting, I would say, element of the numbers of attacks and injured, is that still people are still missing. So the number has now risen this morning to 35. It is very much the number 35 right now of those victims who were killed, not including the terrorists.
That's reporter Esther Gidou in Brussels. She spoke with VOA's Dave Arnold.
More than 700 migrants were rescued at sea yesterday on the Mediterranean. Reuters reports the Italian Coast Guard found the migrants crowded on 6 rubber boats in the Strait of Sicily. After being rescued, they were transferred to a Norwegian vessel and taken to Sicily. The journey from North Africa to Italy had once been the main route for migrants and refugees to get to Europe. That shifted when migrants started sailing from Turkey across the Aegean to Greece. However, a new deal between the European Union and Turkey has sharply curtailed the flow along the Aegean route. In related news, the new U.S. ambassador to Malta, Glenna Kathleen Hill, has met with the country's Home Affairs Minister. They reportedly discussed global terrorism and migration, including the need to monitor the Mediterranean migration route.
Some things are changing in Greece since the European Union and Turkey signed an agreement March 18th to restrict the flow of migrants and refugees. For example, migrant registration centers on the Greek islands are now detention centers for any new arrivals from Turkey. On the mainland, Greece is sheltering thousands of migrants and refugees at new camps, but thousands remain in the town of Idomeni at the Greek-Macedonian border, still hoping it will reopen. Reporter Mariana Karakolaki is following developments in Greece from Thessaloniki. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
We have around 50,000 refugees stuck in Greece. The majority of them, I don't think they know what their next step is. I think they still expect for the borders to open, for the Balkan route to open. This is what was happening yesterday in Idomeni, for example. But they are still trying to figure out what will happen. Some of them will try to apply for asylum in Greece. Others will try to join the EU relocation program, which means that they will apply for asylum in European countries, and then Europe will decide to which countries they will be sent.
Let me ask you a little bit about the former hotspots, the former registration centers that are now detention centers.
Basically, those that were in these centers before March 20th, they were loaded into ferries and were brought into the mainland. Those that arrived in the islands from the 20th of March, and they keep arriving, they're being detained. So old people in the islands, they're in the mainland now, and the new ones are in detention.
And they will be brought back to Turkey?
Yes, this is what's supposed to be happening. For the moment, Turkey accepts all the migrants that Greece is sending back. But we don't know what is going to happen in the future. At some point, they might stop.
So you had talked about the many migrants and refugees that are in Greece really not knowing what their next step is. So how are they being housed or sheltered?
They are in the shelters around Greece, the new ones, the new hotspots around Greece. These shelters and the hotspots are being built by the military, so the military basically built them quite fast. I did not expect that, to be honest. And around 12,000 people are in Idomeni. The MSF are building more tents, but people are staying still in the camping tents. And others are trying to find houses to rent, which is not possible to rent a house with a refugee status. And others are being hosted by Greeks. So some solidarity movements have made this some kind of, not officially a program, but they are hosting people. They're trying to help people.
You were in Idomeni yesterday, and thousands of people remain there. They are reluctant to move from there. Are they still thinking that the Macedonian border will open?
Yes, actually, yesterday there was a rumor that the Red Cross was going to open the border. So a lot of refugees thought that, and they were protesting and they were trying to cross, but they did not breach the police blockade. There are some activist groups that are spreading these rumors, not real activists, of course, not members of solidarity movements. And refugees believe them. They still believe that the Balkan route is going to open, despite everything that the police is saying them, the NGOs are saying them, and everyone is saying to them. So I don't think Idomeni is going to empty anytime soon.
That's reporter Mariana Karakulaki in Greece. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Also, news reports today say Greece will use loudspeakers at the Macedonian border to warn migrants about what it calls irresponsible rumors that the border will open.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Mali intelligence sources say they have arrested two men in connection with a March 13th terrorist attack in Ivory Coast that left at least 19 people dead. The Associated Press reports the suspects were arrested in Goundam in northern Mali yesterday. Three others from Mali have been detained in Ivory Coast. The attack on the popular beach resort of Grand Bassam resulted in the deaths of 11 Ivorians and tourists from France, Germany, Lebanon, Macedonia, and Nigeria. Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch claimed responsibility for the beach attack and for the deaths of dozens of civilians in earlier assaults on hotels in Mali and Burkina Faso.
Two Nigerians are going to Cameroon to possibly identify a girl who says she was kidnapped by Boko Haram insurgents 2 years ago at a boarding school in Chibok. The girl was one of two detained by local defense forces in Limani, near the Nigerian border. Limani has been a frequent target of suicide bombings. Authorities say the teenager was wearing a suicide bomber's vest when she surrendered. The other girl was also carrying explosives. A third girl reportedly ran away. The girl told investigators she was one of 270 kidnapped in Chibok by Boko Haram. A Nigerian official says the two people traveling to Cameroon are leaders of the Chibok Abducted Girls Movement. The abduction sparked international outrage and the Bring Back Our Girls social media campaign. While about 50 of the girls managed to escape, at least 219 of these girls remain missing.
Sudan and the United Nations have signed an action plan to prevent the government recruitment and use of children as soldiers. The UN describes the plan as a milestone in protecting children across Sudan. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
The signing ceremony of the action plan was witnessed by the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, the Office of the UN Resident Coordinator in Sudan, and the UN African Union Mission in Darfur, or UNAMID. It lays out a series of measures to protect children affected by armed conflict, including the prevention of child recruitment and the release of children from national security forces. Alison Parker is UNICEF's Chief of Communications in Khartoum. She says the signing of the action plan by the Sudanese government marks the loss of several conflict-ridden countries, including Yemen and Somalia, required by the United Nations Secretary General to protect children.
Sudan is the final of the seven countries that have actually signed the action plan. So now all the countries that have one form of conflict or another have now made a commitment through this action plan to ensure the non-recruitment and use of children by armed forces.
Parker says the UN will work as a partner to help facilitate implementation of the plan.
This is a culmination of years of negotiation, years of discussion, and years of working together to make sure that we have a plan that can actually be rolled out and implemented.
Parker says the action plan is more than lip service.
It provides a legal framework to prevent the recruitment and use of children. And children are defined as people, persons under the age of 18. The second aspect of it, it allows access of children already affected by recruitment or use by either armed forces for their release and their reintegration.
The partners to this action plan agreement will form a monitoring and accountability mechanism to ensure that children are not recruited to take part in armed conflicts. Parker says violators will face penalties.
The attack on schools, it also looks at the issue of monitoring and reporting on the killing and maiming of children. It also looks at issues of gender-based violence. Children affected by conflict, not just in terms of recruitment, but all the other impact that, you know, crisis and conflict and, you know, wars may have on children as well. That's sort of the comprehensive package around this.
Once the document is signed by government officials, the action plan becomes effective immediately. Parker says Sudan government is expected to respect the terms of the action plan.
As of yesterday, the expectation is that each and every one of the signatories to the action plan will automatically begin the implementation.
Upon the successful completion of all measures agreed to in the action plan by the Sudanese government and verification by the United Nations, the Sudanese government security forces will be removed from the annexes of the Secretary General's annual report on children in armed conflict. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
The Algerian Defense Ministry says at least 12 Algerian soldiers died yesterday when their helicopter crashed in the south of the country. Two other soldiers were injured. The crash occurred near the town of Ragagain in the Tamna Rasset region. That's about 1,900 kilometers south of Algiers. The ministry says the helicopter was on a reconnaissance mission. Military officials say the Russian-made helicopter apparently experienced some technical difficulties. They offered no further details regarding the crash. Mm-hmm.
Malawi lost much of its foreign donor support following the 2013 government corruption scandal known as Cashgate, but things could be looking up. The International Monetary Fund now says it will disperse the remaining $30 million in assistance under the institution's Extended Credit Facility, or ECFF, program. Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre on whether this will reassure other donors and prompt them to provide funds once again.
A team of International Monetary Fund wrapped up a two-week visit to Malawi with some good news. Recent banking reforms have helped tame inflation, and the IMF is projecting 3-4% growth in the coming year. Major reforms to the public management, however, are still needed, said IMF delegation leader Earl Williams.
I particularly refer to having bank reconciliations so that we can give an account of execution of the budget, as well as reporting on the arrears if they do arise. So these are the two key elements that we would need to go forward.
Malawi's Finance Minister Gudo Gondwe says authorities have made monthly bank accounts reconciliation a requirement for government offices.
I hope very much that it will be possible to continue working hard as we've done, so that next time Mr. William comes, he will say the same thing, that we're doing a little bit better.
In September, the government had a verification campaign to remove ghost workers from its payroll. The results of that audit are not yet public. Malawi has to reassure foreign donors if it wants them to resume aid that was cut at the end of 2013 when the Cashgate corruption scandal broke. A British auditing firm hired by the government discovered $32 million United States dollars in government funds had been paid fraudulently to contractors, in particular private construction companies, for goods and services that were never delivered. About 70 business operators and government officials were arrested. 10 people have been convicted of theft and money laundering, including the supposed ringleader, former party official Oswald Rutepo. When foreign donors got aid, Malawi lost an estimated $150 million annually. The country relies on foreign assistance for about 40% of the national budget. Now Malawians want to know if other donors will follow the IMF's lead. Not yet, said the European Union representative in Malawi, Michel German. He told a local radio last week that the EU will make its assessment at the end of 2016. German's ambassador to Malawi, Peter Votz, told VOA he is optimistic.
Malawi is showing now a clear commitment to reform and to modernize its public financial management system. I think if we continue that way, we are on a good way forward.
In the meantime, the government has been forced to economize, including eliminating services like free meals to patients in public hospitals and cutting funding for the education sector. Lamech Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Marty Curcius, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk. Social media. Are you a participant? Do you have an online account? Has it affected your life? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing social media. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. next on Straight Talk Africa. We will talk about the empowerment of women. Is it a myth or reality? Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.